would imagine if I was a leaker at this point, I wouldn't be employed anymore at Mossack Fonseca. I would have gone on leave or something like that.
2.6 terabytes of data. That is how much information was leaked out in the now infamous Panama Papers. But this week on Download This Show, exactly how did they manage to get that much information out? And what kind of risk is that leaker at right now?
It's more than likely that they've done it over a fairly long period of time.
Plus, there are over 100 million Snapchat users. There are over 9,000 snaps per second every day. However, what does the super ephemeral social network beloved of teenagers mean for the news business? Plus, we are pulling apart the cult that is Tesla, and is Medium the key to the future of long-form journalism? All that and much more coming up. This is your guide to the week in technology, the media and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to Download This Show. And don't forget, you can tweet along. The hashtag is Download This Show. You can also head along to the RN Download This Show Facebook page and let us know what stories you'd want us to cover. In the studio this week with our panellists, we have Claire Riley. She's a writer with CNET. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
And we have yet another new recruit, Matt Beachy, who is the founder of Startup Daily. Welcome to Download This Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Oh, there's pressure on that now, isn't there? Yeah. He's excited. We have to do something. We have to perform,
really
Claire.
That'd be really good.
A little bit later on in the program, yes, as I mentioned earlier, we will be on the hunt for the Mossack Fonseca leaker. What would it involve right now? What's going into that search for that person? We're going to be talking to a security expert on that. But before we get there, Snapchat Discover. Snapchat Discover has been a huge boon for media companies. I think Cosmopolitan receives an average, this is over in the US, receives 20 million views a month from Snapchat Discover alone. The CEO of BuzzFeed has said 21% of his company's total traffic comes from Snapchat Discover. Claire, before we get into it, how does it work? This is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I know, right? It's Snapchat Discover is kind of news baked into Snapchat. So if you don't know what Snapchat is, it's essentially a quick burn after reading video messaging service. So I take a photo with my phone or I take a little video, I scroll on it with like a kind of a pen tool, I type something over the top, I send it to a friend, they can read it. It used to be the case that once you'd read the message or seen the video, it was gone, you couldn't get it back. Great for sending nude selfies, I'm led to believe.
Also, I'm told. I mean, no, yeah. We haven't done it.
But they've changed and Snapchat's really become so much more than that. And so they've got this Discover feature, which is in Australia, BuzzFeed, News.com, Fox, all these different sites are putting their stories out like that. So they're kind of these short videos, the ability to have text. It's kind of like a really visual form of content.
They're starting to actually become what I think will be a Netflix competitor, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think that their focus on video and their focus on Snapchat stories, which is another service that everybody's allowed to kind of have their own reality show and that kind of thing on Snapchat. I think that that is going to be where they head with Discover eventually. I think that they'll start creating their own content. Well, they did. I think there was a...
There's a sitcom series.
Yeah, like they had a sitcom and it was called... Let me just see.
Matt's come with... you can tell first-time guests on the show because they have notes.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
I do have notes. I have lots and lots of notes.
Gone in 10 seconds.
It's something like Literally Can't Even, it was called. Oh. And so that just kind of gives you a bit of an insight as to the audience that Snapchat is trying to target.
It caused me physical pain, Matt Beach. Yeah. You start up early when you said those words. We should actually talk about the cultural difference because there's a fantastic article that you sent me through, Claire, which is kind of the way younger audiences, teenagers, millennials engage with Snapchat is actually very different to the way that they engage with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. It's like the ephemeral nature of it has shifted.
It's probably shifted attention spans too.
Yeah, right. So just walk me through in your view how it is different.
Look, it's funny, you know, you hear stories about young people saying, oh, I'm not even on Facebook anymore. My parents are on Facebook. You know, my mom's favorite appliance brand is on Facebook. Why would I waste my time? This is how young people speak.
And people say Radio National.
It's really different. That article I sent you was great. It was a BuzzFeed writer. It's like, okay, I'm going to talk to my younger sister about how she uses Snapchat. How many snaps do you get in a day? Oh, like hundreds. What do you mean hundreds? This guy had been like crafting a video message, putting something on the top, sending it away. And she's like, no, no, no. I send a quick selfie in the morning. I put some filters onto it. I send it off. I send it to my followers. You know, you've got to have a set number of followers. You've got to get this many snaps. If you don't have this many snaps coming through to you, then why are you even wasting your time? Taking a static image and just juicing it up with filters and like text over the top. Stuff that I didn't even know how to get those features on my phone.
Nor do I.
I send like a photo
There's a room
of my
people in their 30s right now who have never felt older. I swear to you.
Exactly. And it was one of those things where I was like, oh, this is that feeling. This is that feeling that my parents had when I talked to them about certain stuff. But it was like, I'll send a photo of like a martini I'm having at a bar, and I might put a little witty aside in text. But you look at these snaps that this girl was sending, and it's like information, visual overload, and it is really fast and consumable, and it is ephemeral, and you don't need to dwell on like the seriousness of the content. And
yeah, and in addition to that, it's replaced text, it's replaced WhatsApp, it's replaced FaceTime. You can do all of that within the Snapchat environment now. So there's no need for any of the other apps or services that you get with your smartphone anymore.
This is what I'm fascinated by, because you mentioned earlier about attention span. Matt, do you think it is the speed at which the technology and the communication that it allows, do you think it does change attention spans, or have attention spans at that age always been incredibly tight and the technology is just matching up to meet what 13, 14-year-olds demand?
No, I think that we're getting shorter and shorter with our attention spans, and I am kind of scared by what comes after Snapchat, because how fast is that going to be?
Literally that fast.
When we talk about Snapchat Discover, often what we're talking about are almost legacy media outlets. It's big news organisations, even the likes of Discovery Networks and MTV. These are organisations that have their roots in television and quite old forms of media. Are they doing a good job of delivering their content at the speed and at the tenor that 13, 14, 15-year-olds are after?
No.
No, right, okay.
No, they're not. Like, if I look at the way that News Corp, for instance, and News Corp have a full team on Snapchat, but I don't think they're doing a good job in comparison to someone like a BuzzFeed who are
native,
you know, they're doing some really cool cartoons and that kind of thing. Even I think that they could go a little bit further when you look at what the Australian BuzzFeed is doing in comparison to the American BuzzFeed, for instance. But news.com.au are just literally putting a story up that it's like an instant article. It's not anything
paragraphs.
Flashy or anything like that. And I think that that's actually going to be detrimental to them if they keep on doing that.
Can they do it? Can you take the articles that they traditionally make? And because it strikes me that the sorts of content, the sorts of things that matter in that realm are quite different to what matters. In the same way that, you know, what worked in a newspaper is actually quite different to what works on a website.
Yeah, these organisations can't view the new platform as another way to clip the ticket on existing content, because that's what a lot of them are doing. And so we see this with Snapchat saying, all right, we've got this story, one of our more listicle-y kind of stories, shorten the paragraphs, put an image on each of those little paragraphs, and people can swipe through a story. It's not a very interesting way, and it's not a really great way to, you know, imagine someone who works for a newspaper suddenly getting a TV channel and thinking, well, I'm just going to sit on my TV channel and I'm going to read out the newspaper.
Okay,
and
you literally just describe what I do at 7:30 every night.
Yours is much more dynamic than that, Mark. But you can't view...
You have graphics.
You totally have graphics. And you have Jan Fran, whose earring game is so strong. I said it on national radio. But I think what we're seeing is, and we've seen it in other ways as well, we saw it when the big agencies like Fairfax and News came and they tried to do what BuzzFeed was doing, or doing what some of these, what started out as clickbaity kind of websites and then moved into, actually they're doing amazing journalism. You see the tennis racket story that BuzzFeed did. They're actually moving back to serious journalism as well as giving...
But it's not necessarily moving back to it. It's a raft of different kinds of content. So one of the striking things about the really successful new media organisations, most of which are coming out of the States, so your Vox Medias and your BuzzFeeds and stuff like that, is they provide different formats of storytelling to match the narrative. So there are things that just work better as listicles, and there are things that work better as long reads, and they have the sort of maybe because the brands are fresher, there's no resistance to them varying the format.
And what the issue is that I see is that News and Fairfax are taking just one type of content and they're trying to spread it out in different media and say, all right, let's just push this and like squeeze it into a Snapchat, make a BuzzFeedy style clickbaity story. But it's like your story is still the same. You've got to upgrade and you've got to change from the ground up.
Absolutely. All right, you are listening to the voices of Matt Beachy. He is the founder of Startup Daily, and Claire Riley, who is from the technology website CNET. Mark Finelli's my name, and you are listening to Download This Show. It is your guide to the week in technology, the media and culture. And normally when you hear about people lining up around the corner to buy something, 9 times out of 10, it's an Apple product. Or it's sales day down at one of the big department stores. But not this last week. Some 50 people in Sydney and a similar number in Melbourne lined up to pay $1,500 to secure not an actual product, but just an early delivery of Tesla's new Model 3 electric car. Now, what's weird about this is that not only do they not get anything at the end of that process, they don't know what the car will look like, they didn't know what the car will drive like, they don't know how much it'll finally cost. This is a weird commitment. What is it about the Model 3 that kind of provokes this passion, Matt?
Well, it's sexy. It's like the sexiest car that I think exists at the moment.
But they've never driven the damn thing.
Well, you know, there's some videos of people driving it. But the thing with this is, you know, it could mean the end of petrol cars. Like, there's actually big shifts from an environmental perspective, from a social conscious perspective and that kind of thing, which I think that people really buy into. And I think that what Tesla has done is done a really good job of making sure that they, you know, have more expensive vehicles and that kind of thing to begin with. And you see, you know, the people in Silicon Valley that can afford the $200,000-$300,000 Tesla model and drive it around. And now this is accessible to me. And it's, you know, good quality. Elon Musk is a visionary and people want to align themselves with that.
Musk definitely has the vibe of Steve Jobs reincarnated, but without the turtleneck.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm sure he'd look very good in a turtleneck. Claire, is the brand around Tesla as potent as, you know, Apple and, you know, 20 years ago, do you think?
Not yet, potentially, but it is going to get there much quicker than Apple took to get from the 1985 commercial to today. Yeah, people are willing to line up because the luxury around the brand, they get the halo effect from the previous Model X, Model S and the Roadster. The premium positioning of the brand has taken electric vehicles from something that was kind of, I mean, we remember that South Park episode about the smog in the air. Suddenly everything's changed and electric vehicles are cool and they are sexy, and that was really important. I mean, I was at the launch of the Model S in Australia, and playing kind of like Rocky-esque music as everyone like runs up on the stage to get their key for the first 10 cars that are out in Australia. The specs behind it are good. I think people were willing to line up because Elon Musk and Tesla, they really do just create this, oh, the product's here. Oh, yeah, and it's awesome, by the way. Here's our Powerwall home battery storage solution. Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. It absolutely beats the competition. Oh, yeah, you can have it now. And it's not as expensive as you thought it might be.
Where are we at with the practical side of it in terms of, you know, being able to charge them throughout Australia at the moment? Like, let's say hypothetically, if you've got one of these right now, what are your options around the nation at the moment?
On the east coast of Australia, they started in Sydney. Mm. They've done kind of premium partnerships with the Star to get superchargers in the Star. They've moved
it's the hotel, yeah.
Yeah, the yeah, Star okay, Casino yep. and Hotel. They've moved up north with the idea of bridging between Brisbane and Melbourne. You'll be able to go without worrying about charging. They have done in sort of smaller stations, places like Port, Gundagai. So the only issue is getting across the mountains, going west. That's going to be your issue. But if you're moving between the big cities on the eastern seaboard, they say you'll be fine. Plus you can charge at home.
What's your timeline, the two of you, on how long it'll take electric cars of this nature to go completely mainstream?
I think that it's going to be, well as we know, Elon has open sourced everything about Tesla. So there's no excuse for other car manufacturers to, and I'm sure that they're all working on some sort of thing.
Yeah,
now.
There's a lot in the US.
I think when it becomes competitive to buy one, and when Tesla has actual competition from existing car brands, that's when we'll start to see that mass adoption. That's when we'll start to see that, you know, it's a it's something that might replace petrol cars altogether.
Claire, any,
yeah,
any
I would say, I reckon we could see 2030. It's much more mainstream. Obviously, it requires the charger network, but in the US, we've already got Nissan and I think Chevy are both working on models, and they're quite happy for Tesla to be launching the Model 3 because it brings competition. It kind of lifts
it's
all
It's a little
boat.
Bit like how when Netflix launches in a country, it gives rise to all the competitors because the category lifts all together.
That was a much better way than saying lifts all boat, as I just tried to say. But the rising tide lifts all ships, as, you know, there's growth in the category. It's going to be good for everyone.
It's always fun when you have a stroke live on there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to buy one. So, you know, there's the market sorted already.
Download This Show is what you are listening to. That is the sound of Claire Riley, who's clearly in the pocket of big Tesla. And Matt Beachy is the founder of Startup Daily. And it was the biggest leak in history. Terabytes of data. I am, of course, talking about the Mossack Fonseca leak. One of the largest coordinated journalistic endeavors in the history. And at the center of it is presumably one, possibly more, leaker. But what would be involved in tracking that person down? Have you wondered about this? Well, Ernest Fu is a security researcher with the Queensland University of Technology who deals precisely in this area. And he joins us now on Download This Show. Dr. Fu, thanks so much for joining us here on the show.
Oh, no problem.
If you were the person in charge of trying to track down this person, which is, you know, let's just play a little bit of role play here, where would you start? What's the first thing you would do to track down a leaker in this instance?
So they'd be going to Mossack Fonseca's systems, and they'd be looking at the logs on those systems to check to see if the leakers left any traces of when they've acquired the information. And they'd probably be trying to work out when that the leaker has been able to actually get that access. Then they'd have to actually narrow down the pool of employees who had that access, and then they'd start to look for strange behaviours with those particular people. I would imagine if I was the leaker at this point, I wouldn't be employed anymore at Mossack Fonseca. I would have gone on leave or something like that.
Isn't that a bit of a red flag in and of itself?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I guess that's the thing in that if you are this person, you have two choices. You can say, okay, I'm going to be really brave and pretend that nothing's gone wrong and I'm going to go to work every day and pretend that it wasn't me. Okay. Either that, or they could have planned ahead and said, all right, I know that the journalists are going to release to the public on this date. 6 months before that date, I'm going to leave the organization and go work somewhere else, leave the country or wherever they are, and hide themselves. And I, being not very brave myself, I would imagine the second option would have been the one I would have taken. Actually, get out of Dodge really quick.
I'm wondering how you evaluate... The logic goes that it's most likely that the leaker slash leakers, possibly, in this context, access this information over a long period of time. Why would that have helped them from a security standpoint?
Well, purely because of the sheer amount of information that they were able to get. So the 2.6 terabytes, if you were to sit down and download that in one sitting, that would raise some flags on a lot of intrusion detection systems and logs and other kinds of things. So it's more than likely that they've done it over a fairly long period of time. And I guess also it does depend on what privileges, in terms of system privileges, the leaker has. So if they're a system administrator, say, then sure, they might have been able to download it, basically all the information that the company has, but they'd go back afterwards and change the logs to hide their traces. So it does depend on who they are. So if they're a law clerk or an analyst there that doesn't have those privileges.
Dr. Fu, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, that's okay.
That is Dr. Ernest Fu talking from the Queensland University of Technology. This is Download This Show. It is your guide to the week in technology, the media and culture. And it is a very big welcome back to our panelist. Matt Beachy is the founder of Startup Daily, a technology website dedicated to what's going on in the world of startups in Australia. And Claire Riley is a journalist at the technology website CNET. Ark Fidel is my name. It was once the writing platform beloved of writers who would write long-form pieces and want them to look beautiful. It is Medium. But this week, an interesting thing happened. A variety of different media ventures, very popular sort of niche media ventures like The All, The Ringer, announced that they would now be publishing their content on Medium. So what is it about this particular... Actually, I'll start with you, Claire. How would you go about describing Medium to people?
How would I indeed, Mark? It turns out I was totally off base when it came to knowing what Medium was.
Because it's from the guys that originally founded Twitter.
That's right, yeah. So imagine Twitter as the 140-character way to share whatever is on your mind grapes. Medium is a slightly longer form of that. So it's a platform by which people can share their thoughts, views. It really builds itself as, there's a lot of dross on the internet. Let's try and get some good quality writing back on there. So it's kind of a combination of platform like you would get with Blogger or WordPress, but it sort of puts all your writing into a neat, pretty style. It just kind of glosses it all up for the interwebs. But it's also kind of a website in itself of like it's kind of a publisher because you're hosted on Medium, but you go to Medium to read great stories on a particular topic. So it might be, say, on the Fonseca leak, or it might be on the iPhone hack. And, you know, you get to see content kind of in that ecosystem.
When it first launched, Medium just sort of looked like a nicer than average blogging platform that had a social element to it where you could follow certain people on Medium. And it sort of seemed like, what was the real point of it?
Well, I mean, the platform's had its this kind of like identity crisis from the very beginning. It first started off like, you know, it's a place to come to find unique perspectives, which, you know, once they thought that was a little bit of a wanky title, yeah. Then they kind of like said it was a blogging platform for influential people to share their unique perspectives.
Okay, well, I'm not the only one who's confused.
That
then.
Kind yeah. of thing.
You know and what happened? So, for those of you listening to the radio edition, everyone in the room's eyeballs just rolled so back, far back into our heads at that
moment.
It
was all whites.
Yeah. And it was, you know, the successful things that they had going for it was that it was, you know, a really, really clean UI. It had, you know, a very easy user experience and that kind of thing. Where it's been very successful is in that Silicon Valley bubble. If you look at like the top rated content in that, it's all about, you know, how I started my business or why I failed and had to shut this down and that kind of thing. And, you know, it's become the platform of choice, I suppose, for VCs, investors, founders, that type of, you know, demographic to diarize what they're going through. And
so if you don't have a Medium account, you're a nobody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, but well, they actually started out very exclusively. Like you had to actually be invited to write on it and that kind of thing. Now anybody can write on it. And I think they've got about 13 million users last time that they publicly announced it.
Right. So, what is actually in it? See, we've got The All, we've got The Ringer, Bold Italic, you know, kind of very beloved niche outlets here. What is it that's in it for them? What are they getting out of this relationship with Medium that they weren't on some other publishing platform?
I think that what they're getting is Medium are actually, from what I understand, helping them with their ad sales.
Right.
And I think that the whole sales concept to publishers is that you do what you do, create great content, we will monetize it for you. But I don't think that's going to work in the long run. I don't think it's scalable. If they have to sit down with every single client, Medium, and come up with some whiz-bang way in how to integrate into their platform and have content, native content and that created, I don't think it's going to work.
One of the striking things, I guess, about that list of people is that they are niche, and maybe they don't necessarily, and they do content that people love deeply because it's long form and nerdy. And maybe those sorts of organizations don't really want to have to invest in sales teams and things like that. And maybe that's the appeal, that it's lifting that commercial end of their business out of their day-to-day dealings.
I mean, that could be fair enough. It depends. It also depends on what their overheads are, how big are their editorial teams and that kind of thing. Because remembering that in the past, if they had an internal salesperson selling, they get 100% of that revenue. What's the split going to look like on this? Is it 50-50? Is it going to be 60-40? You know, those are all big questions that I'd want to be knowing the answers to before I would agree to anything, and then even kind of see what's the timeline going to look like in terms of, you know, budgets. Do you hit a certain budget every month and that kind of thing? What if nobody wants to buy stuff on Medium? Then you're going to have a small publication close down because they're not going to be able to keep afford doing stuff.
One of the interesting strategies behind Medium as a company has been basically signing up high-profile actual personalities. Mm. So Bill Simmons was the guy who ran Grantland, which is a sort of beloved site that existed on ESPN for a while and did a mixture of sport and popular culture and whatnot, and they had a falling out and he left. And Medium kind of signed him up quite quickly. And one of the interesting things I do think about Medium is that it's sort of it's codifying like brand personalities for writers in a way that no other service really does. Like, you know, as a writer and author, you obviously could exist on other social media platforms, but there is something about Medium that, you know, if you're a journalist or somebody who writes long confessional pieces, it's really geared towards lathering you with the appropriate amount of attention, Claire.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes about, certainly in my own reading, I'm a journalist and there'll be some articles where I read a fantastic piece and
I follow that person.
Yeah, absolutely. But then other pieces where I'm like, oh, I didn't actually know who the byline on that wasn't, you know, pulled out and focused on. The way I see other people sharing content, they don't care who wrote it. They don't remember who wrote it. I've had people send me stuff. When I was doing that, all that Dallas Buyers Club stuff last year, I would have people send me stories and be like, oh, have you seen this? It's like, that person actually copied my story. I was in court today with two other people. That person wasn't there. They've kind of pulled my quotes. Could you stop sharing this crap around the internet? I was at that court case today. Thanks for reading my story.
You need better friends. Yeah, I feel like we say that every time on the show.
But people just don't have this connection with a writer, whereas I think Medium really focuses on that, and that's great for the writer. And if you're thinking about people like A.A. Gill, who writes for Vanity Fair, they have followings, and it's really important that for some people they have a distinctive voice and people want to follow that writer. I don't care about elephant poaching, or I don't care about the dot-com boom of the early noughties, but I'm interested if that person is writing about it.
That's interesting.
I think that
I do care about elephant poaching, by the way.
I think that what Medium does very, very well is it makes the content the hero. So and I am not ashamed to admit that Startup Daily is inspired the design when you read our stories and that kind of thing from the Medium platform, because we want to make the content the hero. And I think that what they've got to be careful of with this whole commercialization is having that let go. And I think that if the content stops becoming the hero on Medium, then they're in dangerous water and somebody else will invent another sexy platform that does exactly the same thing, and we'll be talking about that next time.
I feel compelled at the end to go, dun, dun, dun. You are listening to the voices of Matt Beecher. He is the founder of Startup Daily. Alongside him, we have Claire Riley. Mark Fennell is my name, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is all we have time for. Thank you so much to you guys for coming back on the show. Claire, thanks for having you back on.
It was great.
Matt, not too traumatic.
No, and it was exciting.
Yay! Great. Well, we'll have you back again. If you are hearing the show for the first time, you can go download the podcast on any podcast service you like. And with that, have a great day. Goodbye.